Hello, I'm John Burns, and this is my podcast for folk who like the outdoors in Scotland and pretty much anywhere else for that matter. I've got two guests on today, as my the people who listen to this podcast regularly will know, all three of them. I often struggle to interview one person, really. So this is going to be a new for me. Now, what we're going to be talking about today is about clothing and the evolution of how clothing specifically designed for the outdoors happened, really. Now, if anybody goes in the outdoors, I think has a special relationship with clothing, an unusual relationship, really. Most people in the street just throw a jacket on or walk around in it. But we all know what our jackets have done for us, and particularly that horrible feeling when you open your rucksack and you realise your cagoule is still in the car. So I'm going to explore some of that with Henry Iddon and Max Leonard. Hello, guys.
Hi.
Hi there. Perhaps I can start by talking to you, Max. You're producing a book on how mountaineering clothing evolved. What got you started? What got you interested in that?
Yeah. Well, I am a writer. I've been writing about cycling specifically in the outdoors and mountains a bit more generally for quite a while. And I started in 2016, my own little publishing company. So we make books combining image and text on those subjects, and do a lot of work with archives and historical images, that kind of thing. We made a book a few years ago about the Rough Stuff Fellowship, and they are the oldest off-road cycling club in the world, established 1955. So in that, all these fantastic, amazing photos going back into the 50s of people, you know, hauling their bikes up Snowdon and over Styhead in the Lake District, and you know, over the moors and fells, particularly up north and in Scotland. And I was just fascinated about the clothing that they were wearing in this book and in these foot pictures in that period, because it's very different from what you'd think cycling clothing is.
Yeah.
You know, it's breeches, it's ventile jackets, it's shirts, it's bobble hats, all that kind of thing. And I've been a cyclist for a long time, and actually not been cycling so much this past few years. So I've been doing a lot more hiking and walking and general yomping around. And it just seemed to me that there was this whole story to be told about the clothing that we wear when we go out into the outdoors.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And specifically, the period we decided we'd end up looking at was sort of post-war. So we thought we started in 1953. Obviously, it's a big date for the outdoors with the conquest of Everest.
Yes.
And we take it up to 2000. And really, the story is we're trying to tell is how clothing progressed from being, you know, at the early days, it was woolly jumpers, it was army surplus, it was workwear, it was tweeds if you were posh and lucky.
That's right.
And then you know, the kind of synthetic fabrics came in, and then the kind of Gore-Tex revolution and the explosion of clothing colors and styles in the 80s, and how it really transferred, you know, into the mainstream and, you know, onto the high street in the 1990s. Because, you know, what strikes me as someone who lives in London is that, you know, outdoor clothing is everywhere. And you'll see
it is.
It might be a jacket that's marketed for going up K2, but you know, my stepdad will be wearing a Berghaus for walking the dog. And, you know, you see vintage outdoor clothing now in on the streets of London and Manchester and places. And so it was the whole phenomenon that I think we really wanted to explore.
Well, that's right. Yeah, I mean, I can remember when, you know, seeing someone in an outdoor jacket usually meant that they were hill walkers, and now it probably means they're a drug dealer. You know, it's changed a lot, hasn't it? Can we bring in Henry? What's Henry's? What's your two different roles in this project then?
Yeah, I've been involved in the outdoors since I was a child, basically. I'm in my mid-50s now. I'll say that quickly. And so I started skiing in the outdoors when I was in the early 70s in Scotland. And,
right.
You know, family of outdoor people, I guess. And then in the 80s, mid-80s, when I was sort of I was 16, as a Saturday job, I worked in the Alpine Centre in Blackpool, which was one of the very early kind of outdoor shops.
Yeah, by Peter Gentle.
Peter was a mountain guide and heavily involved with the Mountaineering Association in the 60s. He opened that shop in 69, actually, the year I was born. So I worked there as a summer job, and like a Saturday job in the 80s, and I was super keen on the outdoors. And obviously, when you're 14, 15, 16 in the mid-80s, when you go and you grow up in Blackpool, it's not like all my contemporaries at school would be out and about, you know, playing football, playing on the slot machines, hanging around in town, and I'd be out going, kind of walking. So I was kind of a bit quirky and loved the outdoors and worked in a shop. In that period, that mid-80s period, was when the outdoor industry really boomed massively.
Yeah.
And my English teacher at school, funnily enough, was a guy called Chris Conroy, who reviewed clothing for the Great Outdoors in the mid-80s.
Right.
So like during break at school, at secondary school, I'd go and chat to Chris about like outdoor stuff. And like the latest gear that he was testing, and then a few years later, you know, I was working in the shop, and in fact, when I did my bronze D of E, whenever that was, 1984 or something, Chris lent me a mountain equipment sleeping bag that he'd been sent to review for Great Outdoors, and I used it on my D of E, and gave him some feedback, and then I wore when one of the very first Buffalo. Mountain shirts came out. Chris got sent a Buffalo mountain shirt to test for the magazine.
Aye.
In the 84-85, and he'd let me have it when he tested it, and so I wore that on the hill. I mean, obviously, you know, if a school teacher was giving the pupil gifts now, it would be seen as somewhat debatable. But yeah, back then it was just fine, you know. And and I still wear it, and I've got a Berghaus Red Point rucksack that Chris gave me in 85 that I still use.
So you've hung on to this thing. Let's go back in time, as they sort of say in the movies, you know, and do a quick little tour. I mean, you're quite right in that I did a one man play about George Mallory, and getting George's mountaineering equipment was pretty simple because he basically wore the tweed full Norfolk jacket in those days. Which I think mountaineers, Mallory wore it, and I think it was probably worn sort of possibly 1953. My memory when I started, I think you mentioned army surplus, and there used to be, I can remember there was a great big army surplus store in Liverpool that I used to go to religiously, and every now and again you could pick up something like an ex-World War two pair of woolen long johns, which itched ferociously but kept you warm. My memory of it also certainly is that there were mountaineering shops that sold great gear, but the problem was nobody could afford it. So I don't know. So in some ways, I guess you're probably writing what I think is also a social history, because it's about how things have changed. What's the piece of kit that stands out for you, Max, in your mountaineering journey? Then in your journey in the outdoors.
Oh gosh, well, mine is obviously as well out of this period. I mean, it's difficult to say, really. I mean, I think, like you say, we've all got such huge amounts of choice these days about what it is that we wear. And, you know, I could show you down jackets that I've got, you know, synthetic insulation, Gore-Tex is absolutely ubiquitous everywhere now. The story of how Gore-Tex sort of established its supremacy in the market is quite an interesting one, and how they came into the UK in the late 70s and elbowed their way into.
Well, that's right. Yeah, I can remember my first proper cagoule, which was a massive investment for me at the time, was a nylon Henry Lloyd jacket. And that was basically, you basically walked around in a sauna. You had two choices. You could be cold and wet if you left the jacket off, or you could be warm and wet if you put it on, but you were still going to be wet. And I remember the revolution. When did Gore-Tex sort of first break into the market?
Well, that was 76, 77, yeah, the first Gore-Tex jackets in the UK. But you're right, a lot of the stuff earlier, well, the earlier technology than that was PU-proofed nylon.
Yes.
And a lot of it, like you say, came over from sailing, Henry Lloyd's being a sailing brand mainly. The guys who set up Sprayway had been sailors to begin with.
Yeah.
Peter Storm, which was one of the first brands to be established in the post-war period, he came from a kind of sailing point of view too, Noel Bibby set that up. But Gore-Tex was the first to really crack the idea that you could make something breathable and waterproof. And that was came to the UK via Berghaus in 76, 77 with Mountain equipment very close on their heels. And even they claim, I think, that they were there at the same time or first, but that's a sort of contested bit of history, right?
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
And I was only thinking the other day how the bobble hat has effectively become extinct now. I don't know if you're, Henry, do you remember the period when the bobble hat was basically the signature garment that everyone wore?
Yeah, the big itchy fleece that converted into a balaclava.
I've still got one of those. Yeah,
was the thing to wear. But I mean, a lot of the technology, as Max explains, a lot of the technology was around fabric technology, how things changed. The thing with nylon itself isn't waterproof.
Yeah.
But one of the issues was getting the PU coating onto the nylon, which is something that Noel Bibby worked with Peter Storm and the 101 smock. And then you mentioned about the condensation. There were lots of things done where nylon jackets were then lined with neoprene as well. And there was all sorts of quirky fabrics. There's a fabric called Brolly Bond, which is an absolutely hilarious name for a fabric. and the likes of Don Willans had garments made out of, their signature garment was made out of Brolly Bond. So fabric technology was a huge, originally would gone from cotton and wool.
Yeah.
Cotton was in the likes of Grenfell and then Ventile. And then it became nylon and wool has become back into place now. So
yes,
during the 70s, everything was about synthetics, nylon in the outer garments, nylon base layers. I mean, you refer to woolly long johns. Now, you know, thermal underwear doesn't exist in the outdoor trade anymore. It's now base layer.
Of course.
Because in the past, in the 50s and 60s and 70s, most people would have owned wool thermal underwear.
Yeah.
Because we lived in houses that weren't centrally heated.
Yeah.
You got the
bus
to work and probably worked in a drafty factory or wherever. Whereas now, the general public doesn't generally have, you know, most men, for example, or ladies, wouldn't have long johns or woolly thermals.
No.
Because you don't need them in the day-to-day, whereas in the past, everybody wore them to keep warm. And now, because we live in a kind of, you know, a warmer environment insofar as central heated houses and, you know, we drive to work in a car with a heater on and so on.
Yeah.
People now need undergarments to keep them warm. And the outdoor industry has rebranded them as base layers. And they went from nylon in the 70s and the early 80s, where the woolly jumper died out and everyone was wearing pile and fleece. And then it's kind of, and then there was a battleground in the 80s between the wool industry and the nylon industry. So you would see in a magazine three or four pages of adverts for wool, because they were trying to battle this new instigator, you know, this new kid on the block being nylon insulation. And strangely now we're going back to wool and, you know, merino wool base layers and all organic, you know, natural and organic fibres are now coming back in.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think
it's all excitement about nylon.
I mean, I do remember The fibre pile was like a revolution in a way, wasn't it, when it sort of came in? Because before that, everybody wore basically ragged pullovers that they'd had for years, usually, and which were great, but were heavy. And then you got fibre pile, which seemed to me to be a massive revolution when that came in. Do you remember that?
Well, originally, I mean, Helly Hansen kind of came around with the pile clothing and the pile suits, and that it's our understanding that a lot of that industry originally came around because of the North Sea oil industry.
Right, right.
So pile garments were worn by the kind of riggers offshore because it was warm, durable, worked when it was wet, and so on. And so some of the major players in that, such as North Cape, who were based in Aberdeen, were originally came about because they were making pile clothing for the oil industry.
Oh, right, okay. I didn't
Javelin too, I think, as well. And Javelin made things for windsurfers as well. But to go back to what you were saying, John, about the other thing is that remembering that people had no money, I think that's an important part of the story of the industry, is that a lot of these companies were set up, let's say the important ones that were being set up in the 60s, 70s, early 80s, by climbers and by, you know, hill walking enthusiasts, basically because they couldn't find the kit they needed and they didn't have
like Rab Carrington, I presume.
Yeah, but like Rab Carrington, like Gordon Davidson and Peter Lockie of Berghouse, Peter Hutchinson of Mountain Equipment. They were making things that they needed for their own climbing. And we are generally talking about, a lot of them are elite mountaineers. So they were, you know, right at the cutting edge. They were making things that they needed for their own climbing, but they couldn't find. And also they couldn't pay for because they didn't have very much money. So there's quite an interesting strand of the book in the 70s is talking to people who were making their own clothing. They were making their own cagoules. One guy we spoke to, became a very distinguished climber and worked in the industry. He used to take offcuts of pile out of the bins at the back of Javelin in Sheffield and make his own garments. You have Andy Parkin, who's a very big name climber of the early 80s, I guess, late 70s. Of telling us about a cagoule that he made, but he ran out of yellow material, so it's got one red arm.
and he wore that on K2, and he wore that on K2 because, you know, lower down he didn't need the insulation; he just needed something to keep the breeze off. So he wore, right. You know, and there's a great Alan Fife, who was a mountain guide and great mountaineer based in Aviemore. He showed us a picture in the Himalayas, and with his climbing partner wearing these bright, vivid pink over trousers, and it's a remarkable, you know, scene. And it transpired that he made them himself from fabric bought from Pennine Boats in Huddersfield, who were a big supplier of fabric to the homemade guy or the homemade lady who made their own garments. So they were buying pink fabric, making their own over trousers, and then climbing edge routes in the Himalayas in the 70s.
It is quite incredible how gear that was designed for the North Sea and for sailing sort of came together with the mountaineering community. And I sort of, as you say, I remember the climbers of that era, these sort of elite climbers, were basically penniless because they climbed all the time and obviously had no money. So they couldn't, they were doing cutting edge routes on the highest mountains in the world, but couldn't afford the gear to do it. So it is quite a social sort of industry, the way things have changed. What about, as you said earlier, really, you know, outdoor gear has sort of migrated to the high street now. Which is quite amazing. You'll see people walking around in very expensive, high class jackets that probably never leave the street. And how do you see? You finished in about 2000. Your book runs from 1953 to 2000. Is that right? Well, what made you sort of choose that as a good cutoff, other than the end of the century?
I think there's an interesting sort of natural end to the story there. You know, obviously it will there's cycles of things happening, but in the 90s, like we've all said, there was this great big crossover into the mainstream.
Yeah.
It probably came at the end of the 80s onto the terraces with the football fans, and then into sort of music, rave, underground subcultures. But it was also, and then from there, you see it in sort of more mainstream music. So you've got Liam Gallagher wearing Berghaus, and Jamiroquai wearing Berghaus, and showing that it's a thing that's crossing over. But also, a couple of other industry insiders who we spoke to told us that, you know, in the 80s and 90s, outdoor clothing just sort of gave the ordinary bloke on the street, you know, a sort of uniform to wear. Is that, you know, they, people who might always be a bit awkward going to River Island or Next or whatever and choosing clothes, suddenly had this thing that they could wear that they felt comfy was robust
and effective. Yeah.
But I think the other side of it is the industry was changing a lot in the 90s, and there was a lot of pressure on companies, a lot of which had pretty much manufactured exclusively in the UK, to outsource, send their manufacturing to China and places like that. Yeah. And at the same time, a lot of the companies, for one reason or another, got into financial difficulty or changed hands. So I think if you look in the 90s, you'll have Carrymore, Berghaus, Fraghoppers, Mountain Equipment, all changing hands. And the founders who had probably, thinking about retiring, we're moving on.
I suppose that's right.
I don't know. Is that anything to add to that, Henry?
Yeah, it kind of meshes with my experience, really. I suppose also from what was essentially began as a kind of cottage industry, you'd have to call it, really. It took on multinational proportions then, didn't it?
Because of that, then invariably people want growth. You know, investors want growth. And the outdoor industry still wasn't that huge in the early 90s. I mean, now the outdoor industry is huge, and particularly since post-COVID.
Yes.
And there's a far greater amount of inclusivity in the outdoors now than there ever was. And that, again, was partly came about through COVID.
Yes, it did.
You know, so brands can grow, whereas to some extent, late 80s, early 90s. I mean, in the mid-80s, towards the late 80s, you could still buy breeches.
Yes,
you know, yeah. and so invariably investors wanted growth, and then they could push that into a wider audience, to supply their growth, and they needed growth outside the traditional outdoor industries, really.
Yeah, right.
Okay. Because it is an industry, and the same we said to some extent about the clothing. I mean, there's been a lot of, it's easy to debate. You know, there's a lot of menswear in outdoor, and there wasn't a lot of womenswear. That's a complicated story in itself,
which is an
entirely different conversation. But one of the things to bear in mind is, with regards to that, was that in the 50s and 60s and 70s, people wore their everyday clothes to go on the hill. So, you know, a lady hiker would wear a lady's woolly jumper and a lady's woolly thermal. Because nobody bought outdoor wear in that, even in the early 80s. So, and then also, the industry was only small, you know, and so the companies were making it for what market there was, and they would have to make business decisions is it worth making that sort of thing or that sort of thing or that sort of thing. But also a lot of the clothing was incredibly shapeless. Anyway,
yes, it was.
Or a cagoule in the 70s or a cagoule in the 80s.
Yeah.
It didn't necessarily have, it wasn't cut to match a specific kind of gender body.
No.
It was just almost like a bloody great sack that you
it
put.
It was, yes, I remember.
But there were some innovative females within the industry, hugely. Alison Hargreaves works closely with Sprayway. Low Alpine had females involved in the design area, and one of the Sarah Howcroft, who started Rowan in the 70s with her husband Paul, was a big player in the industry. And Calange is a fascinating brand from the 80s, which was originally started by two women and then continually ran by two women. And they brought a lot of colour and kind of a fashion influence. Certainly, yeah. Rohan and Kalange brought a lot of colour and fashion influence into the outdoors.
Okay. I sort of said rather flippantly earlier on, really, that it was a kind of social history, but very much it is, really. Max, tell me, okay, we're almost out of time. So tell us about this book that obviously we've had a fascinating, we could talk for a long time about outdoor clothing, I think, but you've condensed it all into a book. Tell us about your book.
Yep. So it's called Mountain Style, British Outdoor Clothing, 1953 to 2000. And it's published by my company, Isla Press. We're just right now putting, I'd say, the finishing touches, but not quite finishing touches. Right. But we're on the home straight, and it's going to be published in October, November this year. And it's a 300 page or so.
Right.
Big sort of coffee table style book with, it'll have about 25,000 words in, so a lot of good detail.
A lot of illustrations, a lot of photographs,
but a lot of pictures. It's got old brochures, advertisements, pictures of people using clothing. We didn't really explain our roles in it, but
right.
We've been writing it together, but Henry's also a photographer, so
right.
Studio shoots up and down the country of different archives, working with the brands and with people like the Scottish Mountain Heritage Collection.
Oh, right. So you're launching your book at Candle. When do you expect it to be available to purchase?
Well, it's going to be published, first week or so of November, but right. It's still available for pre-order now if anyone would like to pre-order.
Oh, great, great. Well, you'll have to, I'll flag up when it's actually out for sale as well. It sounds fascinating. Sounds a great book for old farts like me to go through and say, oh, God, I remember wearing one of those things. That sounds to me the sort of thing that we'll be able to do. Well, it is fascinating talking to you, Henry. And Max, I think I've just about managed to interview two people without falling over. So I'll be really fascinated to see the book when it comes out. And I think sounds to me as though you produced a really quite important piece of history about the outdoor community in Britain. Thanks very much for talking to me. All the best for your project.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Pleasure.